Gleanings from the Life of Jacob. That is our theme this morning. Just to review quickly from last week, we looked at gleanings from the life of Isaac. Who can tell me what the basic message was that we learned concerning the whole theme throughout Genesis 15, 16, 17, 18, all the way up until Isaac is born, the whole theme of Abraham and Sarah's laughter. Who can tell us what that was all about? Remember, as we go through the lives of the patriarchs, we're looking at two interconnected ideas. One is the seed, and the other is the land. When we talked about the seed last week, we were talking about Isaac and the way he was born. He was born in a very special way. And that tells us something then about the nature of God's salvation. Can anybody tell us? Why did Abraham and Sarah laugh?
Ariel said because they were so old and it was obvious mm-hmm. that they couldn't have a child according to the natural providence mm-hmm. or normal providence.
Right.
And so it would have taken a miracle
right.
of God.
Ariel, do you remember what Isaac means? The name Isaac? Yeah, Isaac means laughter. Very good. And so when Isaac was born, Abraham and Sarah's laughter was fulfilled. The miraculous happened, and God then produced this heir by sovereign grace. And so we saw then that the inheritance is given on the basis of grace and not works. The heir, Isaac, is produced by sovereign grace, by God working his mighty resurrection power even in the midst of apparent death. Abraham and Sarah seemed to be dead physically, and yet life came from them. The second thought then, when we looked at the land, the theme of the land, was we focused on one chapter in Genesis, Genesis 26. And we read the whole chapter. That's the chapter where Isaac, there's a famine in the land, and so Isaac takes his wife and Rebekah and goes to the land of the Philistines. Who remembers who the king of the Philistines is? Abimelech. Remember Abimelech? He was also the same guy who was around in the time of Abraham. Abraham also went down to the Philistines and did the same thing in chapter 20. Pretended that he wasn't married to his wife and so on. But the theme of that passage, interestingly, by the way, the Bible doesn't seem to be too concerned to pass judgment on whether or not that was a good thing or a bad thing, that Isaac and Abraham both, basically they told a white lie. I mean, technically what they said is true, that they were related, but yet at the same time they were also married, and that was the misleading part of it, was they gave the impression that they weren't married. But the Bible doesn't seem to be too concerned to say either way, oh, that was a bad thing or that was a good thing. It just kind of says it. And then it moves on to other important questions. And the important issue there in that whole passage is that Isaac, living as a resident alien in the land of the Philistines, is living as an alien, the word ger we talked about. And a ger is someone who does not really belong to that particular land. He didn't grow up there. It's not his hometown or his village. And therefore, he does not really have any rights in that land. He doesn't have any rights to justice or to possess property or to even marry within the people of the land. The Israelites were also gerim when they went down to Egypt. That's why they were so easily enslaved. Because of their social status as gerim, they were easily put into a place of bondage and used and abused by the Egyptians for their own building projects. The point that we brought out here is that the patriarchs at this time are living in the land not as those who possess it in reality, but as those who possess it only by faith. In reality, the Canaanites and the Philistines, they're the ones who possess the land. And yet at the same time, interestingly, Abimelech and the Philistines are afraid. Remember how they say, "Get out of here, you're too big for us. You're multiplying, you're too powerful." and we sense that you're stronger than we are. And so they ask Isaac to leave. And this shows that God was blessing Isaac, and that was sort of a foreshadowing of the future when the Israelites would come back and conquer the land. The fact that the Philistines were afraid was a premonition of something to come. They had a premonition that, yeah, in fact, they were going to be annihilated, and that these Israelites would, in fact, inherit their land. And so we saw that we too are Gerim. We are living in the land that God has given to us. This world is our world. It doesn't belong to the heathen. It doesn't belong to unbelievers. They're abusing this world. It's not theirs. It's ours. And yet, it's not ours from another point of view, because we don't possess it. When we are challenged, just like Isaac was challenged and told to leave, we leave. When there's disputes over the wells, Isaac doesn't fight. He doesn't say, "This is my land, take up the sword." No, he simply moves on, digs another well. And that is the way we live too in this world, turning the other cheek, for it is the meek who will inherit the earth. We will inherit, but not yet. We don't inherit in this life. We don't inherit in this passing evil age. We inherit when Christ returns in glory and power with all of his angels. Then we will inherit, and he will give us that inheritance. So gleanings then from the life of Jacob. Let's now turn to Genesis 25. Genesis 25, we'll read verses 19 through 28. This is the birth of Jacob and Esau. This is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife, because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. Afterward his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew. And Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now this, again, tells us something about the seed. Just as we saw with Isaac's birth told us about the sovereignty of God's grace in producing the heir. That is, it's not by the works of the flesh. It's not through Ishmael or through Hagar, but it's through grace. It's through sovereign grace that the heir is produced. Here also, in the birth of Jacob, we also see a similar theme. Except this time, the focus is on election. The focus is on sovereign electing grace. Notice that before the children are even born, before Jacob and Esau are even born, God has already decided. God has chosen Jacob over Esau. Verse 23, it says, "The older shall serve the younger." Who was born first? Esau, so he's the older. And yet, the older shall serve the younger. Contrary to the way it normally is, normally the firstborn is the one who inherits, and the younger sons, therefore, are in a sense serving the older son. But here it's reversed. It's reversed by sovereign electing grace, showing that these two are chosen, one is chosen, the other is rejected, not for anything found in them, but only because of God's sovereignty. Paul, of course, makes a big deal out of this. Turn to Romans chapter 9. Romans 9, verses 10 through 13. Could I have a volunteer? Brian.
Matthew 13.
Yeah.
And not only this, but when Rebecca also had conceived by one man, even by our father Isaac, that the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God, according to election, might stand, not of works, but of him who calls. It was said to her, the older shall serve the younger, as it is written, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated.
Right. Now, of course, the same basic principle was also seen in the birth of Isaac and Ishmael. We see that Ishmael is rejected and Isaac is chosen. But the circumstances surrounding that could be thought of as sort of clouding that truth. For one thing, they had different mothers. Isaac was born of Sarah, and Ishmael was born of Hagar. Hagar was a slave. And so it seemed kind of natural then that the offspring of the slave would not inherit. But here, when we come to the birth of Jacob and Esau, those kind of questions are completely removed. Because here we have two children born from the same mother, and they're twins. They're born from the same mother and virtually at the same time. And so here it is very clear that the only reason why one is chosen and the other is not is because of God's sovereign grace. Verse 11, for the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him who calls. It was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. And then Paul also quotes later on in the Bible, in the book of Malachi, Malachi 1, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. So we see the divine election there, and we see that it's based on sovereign grace. Now, it's important to point out one thing, and that is that the reason why the Bible teaches election is not because the Bible is so concerned to make man look small and God to be this superhuman, almost impersonal force of fate. The illustration that comes to my mind is just sort of this arbitrary oriental despot, you know, one of the great kings of the ancient Near East, you know. He doesn't give a hoot about people's lives. He doesn't care, you know, if they bring some slaves into him. One of them, he says, oh, go and throw him to the dogs. The other one, he says, make him my slave and spare his life. But he doesn't have any care or concern. That's not the way God is. God is not a fatalistic, uncaring being. Rather, the reason why the Bible focuses on election is to show that salvation is all of grace. That's the point. God is not arbitrary. Now, we don't know why God chooses a Jacob and passes by an Esau. We don't have the information for why that choice was made the way it was. All we know is this, that we know one of the reasons was not because Jacob was more righteous and Esau was more unrighteous. We know that was not the reason. And so the reason for sovereign grace, the reason for the doctrine of election, is to safeguard the truth of sola gratia, sovereign grace. God alone is the one who saves us. We're not saved because of our own righteousness. We're not saved because God looks down the corridors of history and he sees, well, Esau's going to turn out to be one who despises the birthright, but Jacob is going to turn out to be a good guy in the end, even though at the beginning he was kind of a weasel. But he's going to turn out to be a good guy at the end. And so that's why God chose Jacob. No, it's just the opposite. The reason why Jacob becomes a man of God at the end is because he was chosen. It was because of God's sovereign grace in choosing him from the beginning and transforming his heart that he became who he was. And so just it's important to keep this in mind, because a lot of times when we focus on the doctrines of Calvinism and the sovereignty of God and so on, it's easy to start developing a misleading and false idea of who God is. As if God is one of these giant supercomputers and he just has a random number generator and, you know, your name came up and your name didn't and just koosh, koosh, you know, there it is. You're, you know, you're saved and you're not. And it's just sort of random and fatalistic. That's not the way it is with God. God is a God of rationality. God is a God of personal relationship with his people. He is a God who is fully just and totally righteous. He does not do anything simply because of some kind of arbitrary thing within him. And so the doctrine of election then has to be seen in that context of being the ultimate safeguard for the truth of salvation by grace alone. Now turn back to the text, to Genesis 25. Genesis 25. And let's read verses 29 to 34. Esau sells his birthright. Here we see the electing grace being worked out in history. Divine election unfolds historically. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with the same red stew, for I am weary." Therefore his name was called Edom. Edom in Hebrew means red. Not only was he red when he came out of the womb, but he also loved this red stew. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." And Esau said, "Look, I am about to die. So what is this birthright to me?" Then Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, and he ate and drank. He arose and went his way. In this way, Esau despised his birthright. And then in chapter 27, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but in 27, Jacob receives the blessing from Isaac that would have been given to Esau. Of course, since Esau was the firstborn, he should have been given the deathbed blessing. The deathbed blessing of the patriarch is ultimately the last will and testament. It's saying, here is the inheritance now, since you are the firstborn. And yet, the reason why this happens, the reason why Jacob receives the blessing, is not ultimately because he and his mother schemed and devised a plan so that Jacob could get the blessing. Remember, he went out and Jacob was clothed in his brother's garments, so they smelled like Esau, and then he also put on some of the skins of the animals on the back of his hand and his neck, so that when his father was blind, of course, so when his father felt his neck and his hands, he'd say, "Oh yeah, you're hairy, so that's like Esau," and so on. This whole deception, really, was not the reason why it happened. The reason why it happened is because God had already said way back at the beginning that the older shall serve the younger. And so this is the outworking again of the divine election. Genesis 27, let's just read verse 35 to 36. After the whole thing is over, Esau comes in and realizes what happened. But he said, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing." That's what Isaac said. Then Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing." And he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" That word supplanted is the word akav, which is the root for the word Jacob, Yaakov in Hebrew. So it says, is he not rightly named Jacob? Isn't it fitting that he be called Jacob? Because Jacob means supplanter, or one who grasps the heel. Now here's the amazing thing. This unworthy supplanter, this one who's a schemer and a deceiver, a trickster, who tries to take away the inheritance by deception, he is the one who inherits. You would think, doesn't make any sense. Why is God giving the blessing, the inheritance, to this individual, this one who does not deserve it? And unlike the other incidents in the lives of the patriarchs that we were talking about, for example, when Abraham, you know, told the light lie about his wife and so on, where the Bible doesn't seem to pass judgment either way, unlike those incidents, here the Bible is making a very clear point. The Bible is wanting you to see that Jacob is unworthy. The Bible wants you to understand that, and that's brought out by the verse we just read. Is he not rightly called Jacob? For he has supplanted me and deceived me and tricked me and grasped me by the heel and gotten something he didn't deserve by an unjust and unfair way. And so the Bible then wants you to see that Jacob inherits by grace. Jacob is given the inheritance only because of God's grace. It's not because Jacob is such a good guy. Jacob is a worm. He's a weasel. And yet God gives him the inheritance. And this is, again, the unfolding of God's sovereign grace all the way back in the election that was revealed before they were born. So that's the seed theme. The seed theme is sovereign election. But now we turn to the land. The land theme tells us that in order for Jacob to inherit, there must be a spiritual transformation. The necessity of spiritual transformation and justification, that is, he must be declared righteous by God's grace in order for him to inherit the land. And so now we turn then to a very involved section in the book of Genesis. It starts in chapter 28, and it continues all the way until chapter 33. In Genesis 28, Isaac calls Jacob to him and says in verse 2, "Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." Isaac sends his son Jacob off to Padan Aram. Does anybody know where Padan Aram is? Barry. Right. Right. It's the same place where they got the wife for Isaac, Rebecca. So I'll put this map up here on the board so you can see. It's kind of hard to see from a distance, so I don't know if you're going to be able to see it way back there. Okay. Can you see it back there? Sort of? Yeah. Okay. Maybe it would help if I sort of emphasized, this is the Mediterranean Sea. This is the coast here. Here's Israel right here. Here's Egypt, Libya. Okay. Here's Greece right here. And then here's Italy. Does that stand out a little bit better when I do that? Here's the Black Sea. Okay. So here's Israel down here. Jerusalem is right there. Here's Phoenicia up here. Here's Egypt, the Nile right here. Now, Padan Aram is up here. We have the two rivers. We have the Tigris going down to the Persian Gulf, and then we have the Euphrates going down, meeting up with the Tigris and going down to the Persian Gulf. And Mesopotamia is this area right here between the two rivers, between Tigris and Euphrates. Padan Aram is a little bit north of that, but it's also between the two rivers. And Haran, of course, is the place from which Abraham originally came. So, now here's the important thing. When Jacob goes to Padan Aram to get a wife, he is leaving the land. Okay, you see how far it is. This is the place where Abraham came from. When God came to Abraham and said, get out of this place, get out of the place of your fathers where you were born, and go to the land that I will show you. Go to this holy special land, the land of Israel. Go down here. So Jacob is leaving the land, and he is now in pagan territory. And of course, you can see later on in the story, when Jacob finally leaves Haran, when he leaves Padan Aram, his wife did what? She stole the household gods. Okay? So even though Laban is, in a sense, seems to be sort of a good guy, because it's okay to get daughters from his family, yet in reality he's a pagan. Laban is not a God-fearer. He's not one who worships Yahweh. He's a pagan. His whole family is pagan. And we see that with the household gods that Rachel stole. Now, the reason why this is important is because this whole section then in Genesis, from Genesis 28 all the way to Genesis 33, Genesis 33 is when he returns back to the land. That whole period of Jacob's life is a picture of Israel's bondage in Egypt and Israel returning to the land. Okay, it's a foreshadowing of what is going to happen to Israel. Now, it makes sense in biblical thinking to do this because Jacob is Israel. That's his name, right? Jacob is Israel, and therefore Israel is in his loins. And so therefore, whatever happens to Jacob is going to be a picture of what will happen to Israel as a nation. So we have Jacob leaving the land and going into the pagan land, and then Jacob coming back to the land. And what we'll see then is that in order for Jacob to come back to the land, he must be transformed. He must be spiritually transformed, and he must be justified, and he must enter into a judicial crisis or conflict, just as Israel did at the Red Sea. Israel at the Red Sea was justified. Israel was saved through judgment. And it was only because of that event, it was only because of the Exodus, that Israel was enabled to enter into the land. And so it is with Jacob. It is only because Jacob experiences this crisis, this judicial ordeal. And I'm talking about the incident in Genesis 32 when he struggles with the angel, and he wrestles with the angel before crossing over the Jabbok River. The Jabbok River is a river that is on the other side of the land. Remember, you have the Jordan going right down here, and you have various little rivers. The Jabbok River is a river on the east side of the Jordan, and therefore to cross over that is to cross into the land. It's getting kind of messy down there, hard to see, but that's the basic point. So let's just go through it real quick. We have, first of all, in chapter 28, before Jacob actually leaves the land, Jacob has his first encounter with God at Bethel, Genesis 28. In verse 10, now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night, because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And then he dreamed. And he dreamed about this ladder that was set up, and its top reached to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. And what does God reveal to Jacob at this point? He renews the promise of the land. You see, the Bible is making this point very clear. Before Jacob leaves the land, actually he may have already left it, but he's on his way to Haran. Before he enters Haran, God comes to him and reveals to him the promise of the land. I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Jacob, or the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south, and in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. You see, the text itself is making this point. The text itself is drawing out this symbolism, this typology of Jacob's own experience. Because the promise that I will be with you wherever you go and bring you back to this land is an anticipation of the ultimate promise that God is going to be with Israel in Egypt and bring Israel back to the land as well. Now, interestingly, in verse 16, Jacob wakes up from his sleep and he says, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. You get the impression that until this incident at Bethel, Jacob knew very little of God. He seemed to be pretty earthly minded in his approach. The inheritance and the blessing that he seized from Esau through deception was simply a materialistic desire, and it was not understood in the context of God's promises and the promises of salvation. But you see, God is reaching out to Isaac, to Jacob. Here you see again the fulfillment of divine election, is that God is the one who calls Jacob. God is the one who makes the initiative and comes to him. And we see this in our own Christian life, in our own experience. We do not know the ultimate decree of God. We don't know the ultimate you know, mysteries of whether God has chosen us or not. But what we do know is we see in the providence of our lives, we see God calling us to Himself. Here, God has come to Jacob, and He has called him. He has called him through this amazing self-revelation. God came to Jacob. God. But God met him and came to him and made this promise to him, even when his mind is focused on other things. His whole preoccupation right now is, I'm going to go off and find a wife. He's not really concerned about the promises of grace and this covenant relationship with God, this communion and fellowship with the living God. But yet God comes and takes the initiative and says, even though you don't understand what's going on, Jacob, even though you don't seem to have any spiritual desires at this point, I am your God, and I am going to be with you. I will be with you in all of your journeys, and I will bring you back to this land. And so Jacob then expresses at least the beginnings of faith in the Lord by saying, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And so Jacob makes a vow in verse 20. If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. And so you see he's making a commitment to the Lord, that he will follow the Lord and even indicate that by giving him a tenth of all that he has. Still, though, his faith is in need of testing and growth. And therefore, we see in the next couple of chapters, chapter 29 to 31, we see Jacob working in Padan Aram, working for Laban in order to get a bride. He works 7 years for Rachel, but then he's given Leah, wakes up the next day, says, hey, Laban, I thought I was going to get Rachel. Then he works another 7 years to get Rachel. And in the process of this, he is being blessed by the Lord. Remember, he's not only being blessed through the sons that Rachel and Leah bear to him and their handmaidens, but he's also blessed in the growth of his flocks. And there's some interesting things about how Jacob makes an agreement with Laban concerning the flocks. In chapter 30, there's this whole story here at the end of chapter 30 about the spotted and the speckled sheep and so on. What this is all about is that God is blessing Jacob materially as a sign of his spiritual blessing. And it's happening by grace again. Jacob is not scheming now. This is God graciously causing his flocks to multiply. Remember, Jacob said that you can tell that I haven't stolen from any of your, that is Laban's, flocks, because I took all the spotted and the speckled ones. And yet the spotted and the speckled ones, the ones that didn't seem to be strong, didn't seem to be healthy, they're the ones that grew and multiplied and became a great flock. And so the conclusion of it all is in verse 41, chapter 30. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. In chapter 31, then, Jacob decides it's time to leave. And so he takes his wives, his sons, and he takes all the flocks that he had acquired rightfully from Laban, and he takes off without telling Laban that he's going, because he knows that Laban is an unrighteous man and that he would do anything to stop it. In fact, we have some interesting information from the secular records of this time period that a man who works in order to obtain his wives from another man, that all of his possessions belong to his father-in-law, technically. And so Jacob knows that Laban is going to claim that all the flocks and all the sons and everything that Jacob has been prospered with by the Lord, he knows that Laban's going to claim it for himself. He's not going to let Jacob go. But he must go because God had promised him. In fact, God commanded him to leave. In chapter 31, verse 11, the angel of the Lord spoke to Jacob in a dream and said, "Lift your eyes now and see. All the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you." You see, God saw the injustice of Laban. God saw that Laban was an unrighteous man, and therefore he's blessing Jacob. Verse 13, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family." Echoing, of course, the same language in chapter 12, when God came to Abraham and said, "Get out of this land and go to the land that I will show you." So God commanded Jacob to flee and to carry away all his possessions. Do we not see here, of course, that just as Israel in Egypt plundered the Egyptians, so also Jacob spoils his adversary, just as Israel did. Jacob spoils the adversary because he is blessed of the Lord, because God is on his side. So now Israel is coming out of Egypt. Now Israel is about to return to the land. Chapter 32. I'm skipping a lot of things here. Chapter 31 is an interesting chapter. Deals with Laban pursuing Jacob, deals with the whole incident of the household gods that were stolen and so on. All of this, chapter 31, is simply to show that God is on Jacob's side. Because Jacob came in the middle of the night and warned Laban and said, "Don't touch this man." And they finally ended up settling, making their peace by making a covenant in chapter 31 and verse 45. But now in chapter 32, now we come to the struggle at Peniel. Chapter 32, verse 1. "So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, 'This is God's camp.' And he called the name of that place Mahanaim." Mahanaim in Hebrew means the place of two camps. So you have God's camp and Jacob's camp. "Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, 'Speak thus to my lord Esau, thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants, and I've sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight.'" You see, in order for Jacob to return back to the land, he has to cross through the land of Edom. The land of Edom being the family and the inheritance of Esau. And Jacob, of course, is afraid. The very reason why Jacob had to leave the land in the first place was because Esau had threatened to kill him. And that was because of the way Jacob had deceptively gained the inheritance from his father. And so now Jacob is coming back to the land, and he knows that his life is in danger, that Esau may still be very angry with him. And so what does Jacob do? Well, he devises a strategy. He divides his people and his flocks into various companies, and he sets them in front of himself so that as Esau comes and meets these flocks, the herdsman can say, "This is a gift from your brother Jacob." And then he meets another herd of flocks and say, "This is also a gift from your brother Jacob." Then he meets another herd of flock and says, "This is a gift from your brother Jacob." And then finally he'll meet Jacob himself. And hopefully with all these gifts before him, Jacob will be appeased so that when he meets Jacob, or Esau will be appeased so that when he meets Jacob, he will not be angry with him or strive to kill him. So Jacob here is in a state of great mental anguish and fear. And you see that he's trying to avoid this confrontation with Esau, and he's trying to appease him. Ultimately, the anger of Esau is a picture of God's own wrath and God's own anger. And the proof of that is in chapter 33, when he finally meets Esau. Notice what he says in chapter 33, verse 10. "And Jacob said, 'No, please, if I have now found favor in your sight,'" he's talking to Esau, "'then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face, as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me.'" Esau is appeased, and Esau does accept these gifts. And that response on Esau's part, Jacob takes as being a picture or a sign of God's favor. Esau's face is as the face of God to him. So therefore, this wrath of Esau is a picture, a type of the wrath of God. And therefore, in order for Esau to inherit this inheritance, which has been promised by divine election before his birth, but an inheritance which he has deceptively achieved through supplanting Esau, in order to obtain that inheritance justly, there must be a judicial crisis. There must be a trial by ordeal. And this occurs then in verses 22 to 32, chapter 32. And he arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, that is, when the man, the angel, saw that he did not prevail against him, the angel touched the socket of Jacob's hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men, and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "What is it that you ask about my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Peniel means the face of God. Just as he crossed over Penuel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip of the socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. In the Old Testament, there are many examples of this trial by ordeal. A trial by ordeal is a conflict in order to decide who stands condemned, or, on the other hand, to prove that someone is innocent. An example of this is the law of jealousy in the book of Numbers. In Numbers chapter 5, it talks about, I believe it's chapter 5, it might be chapter 11, I'm not sure. It says that if a husband suspects that his wife is cheating on him, then the husband can have the wife undergo a certain ceremony where she has to drink a certain kind of water that has some bitter herbs in it and so on. And if her stomach turns sour and all that, then she is guilty, but if nothing happens, then she is innocent. This is a trial by ordeal. In other words, it is a way for a human court to determine if someone is guilty based upon this subjecting yourself to a curse. This happens even today in sort of a kind of a watered-down form. If someone says, "I swear to you that I'm telling the truth," what are they doing? They're saying, "I'm going to appeal to God at this point. And if I'm not telling the truth, then may God strike me dead. And if I am telling the truth, then my life will be spared, and that will prove that I'm right." Now, of course, that is just sort of a pagan, secularized version of it. But in the Old Testament, there were these trials by ordeal. To whoever loses in the trial stands condemned, and whoever wins then is justified. So Jacob here undergoes this trial by ordeal, and in this case, it's a wrestling match. In the ancient Near East, they also did wrestling matches as a way of proving judicial cases in some incidents. In this case, Jacob prevails. Verse 28, "You have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Jacob prevailed in the contest, and therefore Jacob is justified. Jacob is proven to be righteous. He is not condemned. But the interesting thing is that the only reason why Jacob prevails is because of grace. The angel easily could have defeated him as soon as he touched the socket of his hip. And the only reason that Jacob did not suffer defeat is because that angel also provided the grace for him to prevail. The smiting of the thigh, interestingly enough, is highly symbolic. The thigh, in fact, the area of the groin and the legs in the Bible is symbolic of the reproductive power of a man. And therefore, by touching his thigh, by touching his reproductive powers, we are given a picture of the smiting of Jesus Christ himself, because Jesus Christ is the seed of Isaac. In fact, that word to touch in verse 25, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip. The word to touch is a little bit stronger than touch. It means to smite. And it's the same word used in Isaiah 53, verse 4, when it says that we esteemed him stricken by God and afflicted. Christ was stricken. He was smitten by the Father. And therefore, the point is this. Jacob is delivered. Jacob is justified through his suffering. He is justified. He is saved because he was smitten. And therefore, it is only through Christ that we can be justified, because Christ was smitten for us. It is justification through judgment. And that's what we see in the Exodus too. When Israel comes back from the land, they have to undergo the waters of judgment. They must be baptized into the wrath of God's judgment. But that judgment and that baptism was the very means of their salvation, for they were justified and the Egyptians were condemned. Now, there's an interesting commentary on this whole incident in Hosea. Hosea 12 and verses 3 to 6. Hosea is commenting on Jacob's life. And he says, "He," that is Jacob, "took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in his strength," or in his manhood, "he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with God, with the angel, and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us. That is, the Lord of hosts, the Lord is his memorable name. So you, return to your God, observe mercy and justice, and wait on your God continually." The context here is that Hosea is preaching against Israel, and he's showing that Israel has abandoned the ways of their forefather, the one after whom they are named. Their forefather was a man who struggled with God. He was a man who wept and sought the favor of God and achieved that favor and achieved that blessing. And so therefore, Hosea calls upon the Israelites, who have wandered away from their covenant fidelity to God through worshiping Baal, he calls on them to be like their forefather. Verse 6, "So you return to your God," just as Jacob did. "Observe mercy and justice and wait on your God continually." Wait for him to act on your behalf. Now, there's some interesting things in this passage. In verse 3, there's a play on words. In verse 3, it says, "He took his brother by the heel in the womb." So when he was, before he was born, in the womb, he took his brother by the heel. But when he became a man, verse 3, part 2, "in his strength, he struggled with God." And so the author here is making a parallel and saying that we see Jacob's character in the womb as being one who struggles. We see that fulfilled ultimately at Peniel when he struggles with God. And the play on words is that this verse has two verbs in it. To take by the heel is the verb akav. That's the same verb that we talked about back in Genesis, where it says, "Rightly he's called Jacob, because he supplanted me these two times." The word struggled, though, in the second part, "in his strength he struggled with God," is the word sarah, which is the basis of the second name of Jacob, which is Israel. So we see Jacob and Israel here. When he was in the womb, he was Jacob, and he Jacobed his brother. But when he became a man, he Israeled with God. And so the author is making an interesting point, that the very character thing that we saw as being the thing that disqualified Jacob, the very flaw in him that seemed to show that he wasn't worthy of the inheritance, by grace it has now been transformed into a righteous thing. By grace it has now been transformed into his zeal to lay hold upon God and to struggle with God in repentance, to struggle with God through weeping and prayer, that he might find the Lord and that he might be blessed by him. You see, Jacob struggled with his brother Esau in the flesh before he was called effectually by God's grace. And that struggle was merely an attempt to gain the material blessings of the inheritance. But then at Peniel, a mighty transformation occurred. And here, that struggling that he had merely for the material inheritance now becomes a spiritual struggle, a spiritual desire that is only given to him by grace, a spiritual desire to lay hold of the promises of the covenant, not just the material aspect of it, but to lay hold upon God himself, to be blessed by this covenant relationship with God. And God answered him. And at Bethel, which happens in the next couple of chapters, I think it's in chapter 35, after Jacob comes back to the land, Jacob returns to Bethel, and God reveals his name to him. This is referred to here in Hosea 12, verse 4. He found him at Bethel. That is, the angel found him at Bethel. There, God spoke to us. When he spoke to Jacob, he was speaking to us. And this is what he said. This is the Lord of hosts, Lord God of hosts. The Lord is his memorable name. God revealed his name to Jacob and to us. And so what do we see then? Just step back and kind of summarize the whole point. Jacob leaves the land. But in order for him to come back to the land, in order for him to inherit the inheritance, there must be a transformation. A spiritual change must take place. And in addition to that spiritual change, he must be justified by being condemned. He must be justified through this trial by ordeal in which he loses, but he wins. And therefore, he is therefore approved of God. So we see both justification and regeneration in this whole picture. So to summarize, the land, in order to inherit the land, two things are needed: justification and regeneration. Justification is through the smiting of the thigh, that is, through the cross. And regeneration is through Jacob's repentance. He wept and prevailed. Hosea 12 and verse 4. He was seeking after God. The outward conflict of these two men wrestling, Jacob wrestling with the angel, is a sacramental picture of the inner wrestling, the inner conflict in Jacob's soul, that he is wrestling with God in order to achieve this blessing from the Lord. It is a picture of true repentance and faith. And so therefore, after this, because Jacob has now been justified and regenerated, now he meets Esau in chapter 33, and Esau is appeased. Esau then to him is a sign of God's favor and grace. And then in chapter 33, Jacob returns to the land. Genesis 33, verses 18 to 20. He returns to the land and sets up an altar again at Shechem to celebrate that return. Then in chapter 34, there is an incident that is kind of interesting. In chapter 34, we have the incident of Dinah. And I'm kind of running out of time here, but I'll just put it to you very simply. The incident with Dinah has a twofold meaning. Dinah, of course, was the daughter of Leah, and Hamor the Hivite was one of the princes of the country of Shechem. He took her and lay with her and raped her, basically. The sons of Jacob then devise a scheme in order to avenge the rape of their daughter, of their sister. And what they do is they deceive the inhabitants of the land by telling them that if they are circumcised, they will enter into a covenant with them in order to live peacefully together so that they can both be prosperous. But, of course, this was a trick. After the men of the city are circumcised, then it came to pass, verse 25, on the third day when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And this was a terrible thing. They should not have done this. Not only were they abusing the sign of circumcision, making it into merely a military ploy, but they also brought reproach upon Jacob. Jacob says, verse 30, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me, and I shall be destroyed, my household and I." And later on, when Jacob blesses his sons in Genesis 49, he pronounces a curse, basically, upon Simeon and Levi and says that they are bloody men and that they will, if they live by the sword, they will die by the sword. He really is not happy with what they did. And of course, it's only appropriate that Jacob would be so judgmental towards them for this, because we saw already back in Genesis 26 that the people of Israel were living as gerim. They were not living in the land the way they will live when they come back from the land or from Egypt and they enter into the land through conquest. Then they will use the sword to destroy the Canaanites. But here, this is a premature use of the sword before the day of judgment. It's the equivalent of you and I trying to get justice by the sword before the coming of Christ. However, there's also a second level of meaning here. And the second level of meaning ties back with the whole typology of Israel going out of the land and returning back to the land. If Israel or Jacob is a type of Israel returning to the land, then this is a type of the conquest. This is a foreshadow of what will happen. In a sense, they shouldn't have done it because it wasn't the right time. But in another sense, it also pictures for us that, yes, in fact, these Canaanites do deserve this destruction. For they will be wiped out when Israel comes back into the land. They will lift up the sword in order to destroy the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And therefore, from that point of view, one could also argue in verse 30 that Jacob's expression of fear that the Canaanites are going to gather themselves against him and kill him is also an expression of unbelief. He should have been able to trust in the Lord to know that his ultimate goal was not to live in the land and be happy, but rather his ultimate goal was that through God's judgment, Israel would inherit the land. Well, then in chapter 35, God then goes to Jacob, says, "Arise, go to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother." Now the cycle is complete. God says in verse 11, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham, Isaac, and Isaac I give to you, and to your descendants after you I give this land." Here we see Israel in the land. The conquest is beginning. Now Israel is given a new name, and Israel is told to be fruitful and multiply. That's the dominion mandate that was given to Adam in the garden. And that dominion mandate will be fulfilled through the conquest of the land when Israel returns into the land. So that's the gleanings from the life of Jacob. So the seed tells us about sovereign election, but then we see in the land principle, we see that God works out that sovereign election by justification and regeneration, by calling Jacob to himself, taking the initiative, transforming him from a schemer and a supplanter into one who is a prince with God, and therefore who can inherit, who can inherit justly and righteously because of God's grace, not because of his own righteousness or his own transformation. It's interesting, too, that the text moves to these in this order. It starts off with Genesis 25 and focusing on the election principle, and then it moves in chapters 28 to 33 to talk about the transformation principle. If that election principle wasn't there beforehand, you would mistakenly think then that the reason why Jacob really inherits is because he changed and became a good guy after all. But actually we see, because election is in the background, we see that the reason he became the way he was, the reason he became a prince with God, is because God from the very beginning had chosen him and therefore is now working in his life to change him and to transform him into a prince with God. So it's very important to see that context. God does not choose us because we're regenerate. We're regenerate because God chose us. Any questions? Okay, let's close in prayer. Our Father, we thank you for your goodness to us in Jesus Christ. We thank you that he is the one who suffered for us. We thank you that you smote him upon the cross so that we could be justified and approved before you. Father, we thank you that in these narratives of the patriarchs and their lives, we see painted for us in such clear ways the gospel of Christ, the gospel of free grace. We thank you that all the glory goes to you. For, Lord, we recognize that in our